All right. Firstly, welcome everybody back to a new safer. Really, I would say probably the main safer in the VM Rishonim, without question, the Sefer Shmuel. And in order to just give a bit of a hakadama, we're going to give a bit of an introduction to what we're actually going to be doing. I didn't manage to get this printed out, but I'm not going to go through the whole thing. A bit of the Abarbanel. Just to explain, Abarbanel, the commentary of Abarbanel is very controversial for a lot of reasons. The gentleman was famous. He was the guy who, in 1492, when the Jews were thrown out of Spain, he was I think it was like the chancellor of the country or something like that. And he was given the option to stay behind. And he said, no, my people are leaving, I've got to go. And he went. And he went back to Portugal, which is where he came from. He was born in Portugal. And he died in 1508. So between 1492 and 1508, 16 years, this is when he wrote all his commentary. And the man is a phenomenon. The expert on Abarbanel, alive today, or if he's still alive, is Benjamin Netanyahu's father, who is a professor in Cornell. Kind of an interesting thing to know. Professor Netanyahu, I don't know what his first name is. I don't remember now. And his thesis, his PhD, I think it was on the Abarbanel. And it got printed and published, and it's a phenomenal piece of work. So of all the people in the world to know something about the Abarbanel, I guess Bibi knows a bit about it as well, through his father. So we're talking about a very great commentator of the Spanish school, who gives these wonderful introductions. Abarbanel, I'm talking about him a bit because we're going to use his commentary quite a lot. In Shoftim, not so much, and in Yeshua, even less, but when he comes into Shmuel, and particularly Malachim, this was a man who lived in the palace. He lived in the court, right? He knew the king and queen of Spain. So when he writes about kings and queens and he writes about Malucha, he knows what he's talking about because he experienced it. So his commentary is phenomenal. There is a wonderful yeshivish tradition not to learn the Abarbanel on a Friday night. And the reason is because he starts off usually his commentary with about 20 questions, and then he goes through the parasha answering all the questions. So what happens is when you learn on a Friday night, you're so tired, you only get through the question, you never get through the answer, because you're falling asleep by the time you got through that bit. That's it, you're out for the count. So the tradition was never to learn the Abarbanel on a Friday night. Well, I think that's a serious guy. Maybe it was a joke, I don't remember. I'm just going to say a bit of what he says over here. Firstly, the name of the Sefer Shmuel. All right, when you learn the book, and some of you will remember it from your experience of learning Sefer Shmuel, it's about a bit about Shmuel, a lot about Shaul, King Saul, a lot about King David, right? King Elect becoming the king. Not so much about Shmuel in the sense that he's there at the beginning. He dies around chapter 25 of Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1. He's dead already. So the question that Abarbanel is really raising, why is he called Sefer Shmuel? All right? Why is he called the Book of Shmuel if the main thing is really not about him, but it's about David, Saul, about kings? And he brings something interesting. He brings a non-Jewish scribe who, believe it or not, his name was Geronimo. Now, I thought Geronimo was somebody out of the cowboy movies, but obviously not. He said that there was a gentleman called Geronimo who used to write down everything in Latin. He scribed the Hebrew Bible into Latin, and he says that he called the Book of Samuel, he called it Rigum. As in the word rain, okay? In other words, Melachim, he says. So basically, as far as the non-Jewish scribe was concerned, he didn't even give the Book of Samuel the name Samuel. He considered it part of the Book of Kings. And the reason is because who's in it? Shaul, David, you know, it's kings, right? And he says that that is not the Jewish tradition. And he writes that the Jewish tradition of calling it the Book of Shmuel, essentially, he says, nearly, he says, for two reasons. He says, really, the whole thing was the following. Firstly, Shmuel himself was an amazing individual. He says that Shmuel, and this is the second reason, in fact, he says that Shmuel was a Nazir, as we're going to read, he becomes a Nazirite. He's a very holy man. He's somebody who's very special. And therefore, to give kavod, to give honor to the person who is really the man who makes the kings, the kingmaker. Okay, he anoints Shaul, and then he anoints David. He's the guy who's going to make the kings. So if he's making the kings, then he is the guy who is recognized as it were, the person over the whole situation, the over seer of the whole situation, and therefore the book is named after him. And that's one of his suggestions. Of course, what happens after chapter 25 of Shmuel Aleph? He's dead. So then it's taken over by two of the other prophets, Gad HaChozer and Natan HaNavi. Okay, who, remember, Nathan is the one who comes to David after the Bathsheba story and gives him the whole story with the lamb and the rich man and the poor man, which, again, Mitzvah will get there one day. Good evening. And so again, Shmuel, as far as he's concerned, has this incredible thing that he can teach us, the way he conducts himself. And he also says something interesting, that he says that, let me just get the quote over here. He says that Shmuel himself was in fact not only such an incredible person, but he's the guy who basically, I think the way he puts it, the way I understand it, that he's the bridge. He's the link between the day of Shoftim, when you had these individuals who ran the society, the Jewish world, for a certain period of time and then died, and there was no dynastic continuity. And then you've got, by the time you finish the book of Shmuel, you've got the dynasty, the house of David. So what happens is that you need someone to bridge between the two situations. And the person who bridges is not the king who is appointed, but the person who made the kings, who came from the Shoftim and then created the new world of kings. So what did Shmuel do? Shmuel was a Shofet, the last of the Shoftim, and he also went on to create the kings. So therefore, to give him his due respect and recognition, the book was named Sefer Shmuel. Okay, so again, it's all about the person, and it's about the, I suppose you would use the word in Hebrew, tafkid, what he did. Okay, what exactly he got up to, and about his individual merits and whatever. And again, you know, I suggest if you want to see this, look at the introduction to the Barbanel. It's very, very beautiful what he writes, and even when he mentions this gentleman, Geronimo, kind of interesting person to mention. Alright, so that's one thing, and just by the by, I wanted to mention that because I thought it was important. Yes? That's the question that nobody can really give you a straight answer. I'll be honest with you. Who gave any of these titles to the Sefer? The answer is that the Gemara already discusses the authorship of the books. So seemingly the rabbis of the Talmud gave names to the books. All right, but the problem is, how then did the books get divided, and how they became Samuel 1 and Samuel 2? The shocking reality of that, which if you never heard it before, I don't upset you too much, is that it all came from the Christian world. It didn't come from Jewish sources. That's the consensus of most opinions. What does that mean? It means that, again, if you read a bit of Jewish history, you'll realize that in the Middle Ages, people like the Ramban, Nachmanides, people after him, they had these big disputations, right, these disputes. And the disputes were usually about the messianic role of Christianity versus Judaism, which was right, which was wrong. It wasn't very pleasant. The Ramban had a major dispute. It lasted 4 days, and he had to run away from Spain. He went on Aliyah. So that was kind of, for him, a sort of a sign from heaven. But what happened was that in order to facilitate the dispute, the non-Jews, their scholars, and they had many scholars, they divided the books up. So they would say to the rabbi, "Rabbi, do you not know what it says in Samuel 1, verse, you know, chapter 9, verse 3? And of course, he didn't know. He knew Sefer Shmuel, Parsha, whatever. He had no clue as to what they were talking about. And this was done in order to undermine the Jewish argument. So if you can't beat them, you have to join them in this case. And what we did is we adopted, you know, the capital system. And we always use the word capital, you know, like in Yiddish, as if it's a Kodesh. It's a holy word. It's actually, it's a cop-out. Capital cop-out, you know, it's a kind of play on the words. We really copped out. We really gave up and lost the way that we divide the Sefer, and we actually adopted the way that the non-Jewish world divides the book. Because there really isn't two Samuels. There's Samuel, Sefer Shmuel. According to the Gemara, Sefer Shmuel, the Gemara in Baba Batra, page, whatever it is, where is it, 15, 14, around there, the Gemara says, who wrote the Svarim? And the Gemara gives you a whole list of the names of the books, and it certainly doesn't say Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet. It says Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Melachim is the same thing, the Book of Kings, one book. It was never divided into two books. We have this tradition now because that's what it became. But this is a historical thing, and we stayed with it. It kind of it suited our purposes in the end, and now you will find, even from Bnei Brak, that all the stuff that you get printed there will come with Samuel 1, Samuel 2, all the verses. Nobody disputes it. I get the feeling that if they actually knew the origin of it, they might redo the whole thing. But seemingly nobody is the wiser, right? Again, it's kind of just an interesting background to the Bible in general, and how the books were named and how the books were divided. So that's just a bit of background, yeah.
The Koran does in Bereshis, they redid, for example, by Hulu,
yeah,
with Perek Beis, and the Koran put it back into Paracom.
Yeah, you know why? So, you know what? Well, they did two systems there. They did our system, then they did the 3-year system. All right, you know, the way that the Torah was divided in Eretz Israel was always to be read every 3 years, not every year. Right? I always wonder whether that meant they had Simchas Torah once every 3 years. I'm sure they had Purim every year, that I'm absolutely guaranteed. But Simchas Torah, okay, so they only got drunk once every 3 years. I really don't know. I don't know what happened there. But the Koran Bible does have the dual system going down different sides of the page. That I don't know. I've never really looked into that, and this is getting into an area. I've just about exhausted everything I know about that particular point. Anything more than that, you have to write an email to somebody in Bar-Ilan, and hopefully you'll get some sort of answer with a bit more detail about that. There are experts on all this stuff, mainly in Israel. All right, so that's just, again, by way of introduction. Another element of introduction is really just to find the connection, find the kesher between the beginning of the book of Shmuel and the end of the book of Judges, the book of Shoftim. And the kesher, one of the interesting connections, is the fact that we start off with Elkanah, who we know, the father of Shmuel, that he is a Levite. He's a Levi. And if you remember from the end of the book of Shoftim, we had two terrible, frightening, awful stories. All right, the Pesel Micha, the image of Micha, which was such a terrible story in its own right, where idolatry was allowed to happen in Israel, in the north of Israel. And then you had the Pelegesh Begiva, this awful story of the woman who was attacked and died from being abused and everything else, and she was cut up into 12 pieces. If I'm telling you something, I don't really want to go into the details, but if you want to read it, chapter 19, Book of Judges. Basically, it's all revolving. Those two stories revolve around Levim. All right, the main player in the Pesach Micha was this Levite who became the Kohen. All right, who was it, by the way? The grandson. Remember, we spoke about that, of Moshe Rabbeinu. That was a kind of scary thought. His grandson became one of the leaders of the rebellion against Hashem, and that's a pretty scary concept. All this is on the, it's on the web, listen to it, and I can't really summarize that now, but you have to go back into Sefer Shoftim, and we spoke a lot about that. The story of Pelegesh Begivah, the concubine of Givah, is also about a Levi. This Levi who goes wandering, and he's looking for this woman who ran away from him, and he ends up coming to the tribe of Binyamin, and they basically treat him like Saddam, and the consequence of all of that, again, is about a Levite. So there's two stories of Levim, which are very bad, at the end of the book of Judges. So what happens is that as a kind of tikkun, a kind of repair, we're going to have a story about a Levi, which is absolutely remarkable at the beginning of the book of Shmuel. Right? So it's a kind of link, it's a thematic connection. We ended off the book of Shoftim with two stories which were kind of generic stories about the whole period of the Judges, the downside of that particular period, and now we're going to try and repair the situation by giving a story of a Levi, another Levite, who hopefully will bring up the situation to a new level which it was never at before. And this is going to be the story of the father of Shmuel leading us into knowledge about Shmuel himself. And again, just by way of introduction, and a final point of introduction, is that I know that everyone is all clued in to Chana and to Tfilas Chana, and a lot of people have done read about this and written articles and read articles about all these things. And my argument this evening is going to be that, as they say in the classic, it takes two to tango, right? You've got to have a Chana, but what about the father of Shmuel? Okay, a lot is known about the mother of Shmuel, Chana, this incredible woman who prayed for a child for nearly 20 years. She was davening for 20 years, I think 19 years, the rabbis say, for a child. And eventually she was granted this incredible child. But the reality is, what about the father? What is so special about him? What do we learn about him? What do we know about him? What does he do to merit such an incredible son? In other words, you know, where is his spiritual genetic what is his spiritual genetic input into Shmuel. So that's, again, by way of introduction, we're going to be concentrating, at least for today, a bit on Elkanah. Okay, this gentleman who eventually, they're blessed with a child. What is he all about? Where is he coming from? Who is he? What is he? Okay, and that's going to be sort of the focus of today's share. And then next week, we'll talk a bit about the family dynamics. And we may get to it a bit today, but certainly for next week, and see where he went right. And we have to admit, in one instance, he seems to have gone quite wrong. All right, we're going to start looking at the text, and we'll make an inroad here. And again, by way of introduction, there's a lot of intro that one can bring into this, but I hope that Simon kind of sets the scene. Because learning Shmuel, you know, the main thing is really just to get into the meat of what we're learning. So looking at the easy to find, chapter 1, verse 1. Okay, my guess is on page 1, although of course in this book is on page 3. So there was a man from Ramatayim Tzofim, right, name of the place where he came from, Mehar Ephraim, from Har Ephraim, Mount Ephraim, Ushmo Elkanah ben Yerucham ben Eliu ben Tehu ben Tzuk, Ephrati, a man of Ephrat. Now the question is, what exactly does it mean here? And the translation tells us here, for instance, it says Ephraimite. Ephrati, the argument is that it's another way of describing that he is from Ephraim. A lot of people argue, no, that this is really telling us that he comes from, I mean, where is Ephrat today? Near Beit Lechem. All right, and therefore, really, he is a man of that particular part of the world. He is, in fact, a Levi, and this is the gentleman that we're dealing with, this guy called Elkanah. And, of course, it's interesting how it starts off, Ish Echad Min HaRamatayim. Ish Echad, the idea of not just one person, but one can argue, Ish Echad, Ish Miyuchad, a special person. All right, Ish, Ishtader Liot Ish, right, the famous comment from Pirkei Avot, when they need somebody to stand up and to, go and do what they have to do, stand out there and lead, then you've got to be an Ish, you've got to be a person. Ish Moshe Anav Ma'or, this is a title of honor. So Ish Echad, it's one person, a special guy, Mina Ramatayim from this place, and his name was Elkanah, and we're finding out a bit about him. And Pasuk Bet, Velo Shtei Nashim, he had two wives, Shem Echad Chana v'Shem HaShenit Penina. All right, one was Chana, one was Penina. Vayhi lePenina Yeladim leChana Yeladim. Penina had children. According to tradition, she had, I think, 5 children or even 7 children. Don't remember. That we'll see later on. And Chana Ein Yeladim. Chana had no children. And here comes a pasuk which we're going to focus on a bit today. Va'alah ha'ishahu meiro miyamim yamima. This guy used to go up from his city year after year, from time to time, to do what he had to do in Shiloh. Shiloh was the place of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. That's the presence. Nowadays we would call it the place of the temple. But in those days it wasn't yet the permanent temple. And Shiloh was a special place where the tabernacle, the Mishkan, sat for a very long time. I think over 300 years. The Sham, and who was functioning there? Shnei b'nei Eli, Chofni, Upinchas. He had the Eli, who was the high priest. He had 2 sons. One was called Chofni, one was called Pinchas. Kohanim l'Hashem. And they were priests to God. And again, kind of an interesting pasuk, and it gives us some sort of information about Elkanah, that he used to go, basically, and visit the Mishkan. To which, I suppose, the argument might be forwarded, or the comment might be made, Azma, so what? You know, everybody had to go to the Mishkan. You had to go 3 times a year to visit the Mishkan. It was a mitzvah aliyah l'rega. All right? You know, like nowadays, if you try and get to Jerusalem during Sukkot, if you ever spend the Chagim in Israel, try, you know, leave early in the morning if you're driving up to Yerushalayim, because the roads are absolutely packed going up to Yerushalayim. It's a phenomenal thing that people make a very big effort nowadays to go, and nowadays we haven't got a temple, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. And there's still this idea of going to Jerusalem, or going to the Mishkan. In those days they would go to the holy place of Shiloh, and they would be there 3 times a year. So if that's the case, then big deal, what are we really saying here about this particular person, which is so unusual? And of course, again, look, note in Pasuk Gimel, V'alaha Ish Hahu. It's not saying his name over here, it's saying that Ish, that special person used to go from year to year to offer to Hashem in Shiloh, and there were the two sons of Eli, etc. So there's kind of a statement being made here, and the question that I want to deal with essentially this evening is, what is this statement? And in order to do that, I'm going to have to hand out this particular text. And Tzvi, you can be the gabbai. Thank you. I've mentioned this before, and I alluded to it a few weeks ago at the Sudash Lishit. There is, without doubt, a phenomenal, unbelievable background to this gentleman, Elkanah. And again, the text here is a vehicle to a better understanding of what's going on. I'm not looking for tech skills. I'm not asking you to, my students, I give them all these pages the whole time. They all get very, very upset about it because they think that I'm going to test them, you know, word for word. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the ideas. I'm looking so that from the text we can actually gain a greater awareness of this. This is the sefer I'm using is the sefer written by a gentleman, Rav Yitzhak Levy. Yitzhak Levy was a great teacher in Israel. He died about 15 years ago. I think he lived in Bnei Brak, if I'm not mistaken. And his svarim have been reproduced. And he wrote till, and I mentioned this before, he wrote till the middle of Shmuel Aleph. He got to chapter 15 of Shmuel Aleph, and unfortunately at that point he died. And his sons, who seemingly were also are very learned gentlemen, were asked to finish their father's work, and they refused. It's in the introduction to the Sefer. They refused to continue it because they felt that they could never in any way replicate what their father had done, which is kind of sad in a way, because he obviously taught much more than he managed to write down. But we've got it until the middle of Shmuel Aleph, so at least we'll have a bit of it, you know, to get us through a bit of the beginning of the Sefer. So again, the question is, Elkanah, what is he all about? Why is this gentleman mentioned in such a way? He's given a title, Ish, special guy, special man. And the whole concept of him going to the Mishkan and doing what he did, what's so unique? What was so unusual about this guy? Now listen to this, and this is phenomenal. There's a great chizuk here. Elkanah is a very inspirational character. He proves that one person can literally change the world. And it's very much in tune with what we saw in Sefer Shoftim. By the end of Sefer Shoftim, we came to the conclusion, I think, after learning what we saw there, that the whole situation of the Jewish people was very, it was stagnation. They weren't growing spiritually the way they should have done. They got stuck in a groove. They got stuck at a certain point. Their leaders came and then the leader went. So when they had this very great leader, they had a Devorah and they had a Shimshon, everything seemed to pick up, and then it all came down again, and it all stopped. So the question is, of course, now, what is Elkanah doing here in his capacity, which really takes us from the period of the Shoftim into the period of the kings? What is Elkanah going to do, which is going to change the situation? And this is something very special. It's taken here from, where does he get it from here? Tana de Belia, very early Midrashic text. Listen to this. This is fabulous. I always feel it's sort of worth getting up in the morning just to come and hear something like this, although it's late in the evening, but it was worth getting up today just to hear it. Listen to this. Omar Abzeira. Abzeira says the following on the right-hand side. In Nizdaku Matecha Amod Vegidra. There's a concept that if your people or your nation is getting old, make Gedarim, make boundaries. Kishem Shasa Elkanah. Just as Elkanah did, it's a quote from the Jerusalem Talmud. Shehaya madrichet Yisrael lepamei regalim. He taught the Jewish people to go up to Jerusalem, or in this case to Shiloh, before Yerushalayim. They would go to do the aliyah leregal. Hado dichtiv alei shahu meiro. What's going on over here? The Jerusalem Talmud assumes we know, and we don't. So Rabbi Levi writes, Ketzad u'asaza, what did Elkanah do? And listen to this. This is so special. He said the following. Elkanah haya ole l'shilo arba pa'amim b'shana. First thing is, we know there's a mitzvah to go three times a year. So what did Elkanah do? He went four times a year. All right? You'd say it's a bit of a davkening. No. He went an extra time to show the people not only is it an obligation, but it's also a privilege. It's a zechut. And how do you show that? By not only going when you have to go, but go even when you don't have to go. All right, that in itself is kind of a lesson in life, you know, that It's always good, you know, you've got to go and have a shiur and learn or whatever, but show maybe that there are certain times that not only that you're going because you have to, but because you want to. All right, that's a lesson in education, and it's kind of important in itself. So Elkanah decided he was going to go up four times a year to the Mishkan. Shlosha, it says, Minat Torah, Brugalim. Three times he would go, as is dictated by the Torah, on the festivals. V'yachad shekibel Allah b'nedava. And once voluntarily. Okay, and this is a whole discussion. And he brings here Rabbeinu Yeshaya, one of the commentaries on the text. Now, how do we know this? Shenemar, because it said, in the pasuk which we pointed out, V'ala ha'ishahu me'iro, miyamim yamim, and the man would go from year to year, or from time to time, lishtachavod, lizbach, lashem tzvod, b'shiloh, to offer sacrifices to God in Shiloh. Now, what did he do? Allah el kanav ishto banavu b'nei beito. He used to make it into a family vacation, alright? He would get his wife and his children, ubnei beito, and the members of his house. Presumably he would have other people around him, whatever it is, you'll see in a minute. Achiv, achiyotav, his brothers and sisters. Chol krovav ayolim imo, the ganze mishpocha, everybody went up to to be with him, to go to Shiloh. He would literally, you know, you knew that when Elkanah said, come, everybody went. V'amar lahem, and this is what he said. And this is the way that he told them what they're going to do. And it's unbelievable. He said, Limdu derech avodah min haknanim u'min ha'akum. You know what? You should learn the way of service from our non-Jewish neighbors. I'll give you an example, something that sticks in my mind to this very day. I'll never forget this. I was rabbi in London in a shul. This is going back 1990-91. And one of the things we did from time to time is that we had non-Jewish groups coming to see the shul, right? They called me up, they said, usually kids, school children, and they wanted to come and see the shul because they were learning about comparative religion. In England they did that sort of thing, right? It's a good thing. So it was a group of Catholic kids, right? And I didn't really want to get into resurrections and anything. That to me was not really the time and place to discuss it, and thank God they didn't ask me too many serious questions on that. But I'll never forget, we sat in the shul and I explained that this is the bima, this is where we read the Torah, and at the front is where we daven from, and then the women sit at the, you know, we had a gallery there, so the women sat upstairs, and they said, what's over there? And they pointed at the Aron HaKodesh. So I said, that's where we keep the Torahs. And I didn't tell them at the time that the Torahs had silver on them, you know, the sort of thing that we have in every shul in the world. And in fact, one of the Torah plates that I had in that shul was a relic from Moses Montefiore. It was an interesting thing, which I spoke to them about afterwards. He saved one of his trips to Syria. He saved the Jewish community in Damascus, I think, from a blood libel in 1840, 1841. And they made a special silver plate on the Sefer Torah, which was kept in the communal organization. It ended up in my shul. For some reason, I don't know. But it was a phenomenal piece of silver with an inscription. It was a whole history by itself. So anyway, so just to finish the story, I said, okay, we're going to open up the ark. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, open up Vahib and Torah. And so what do? Okay, we open up the ark. These kids sat there, and the gasp when the curtains parted was remarkable. Wow, you know, like this. And I heard it, and I said, I looked at them, and their eyes were popping out. What was so incredible wasn't just the Torahs, but it was the silver, the bells, the decorations. And I made a speech about this afterwards. I said, this is phenomenal. These are 10-year-old kids. And they're seeing the Aron HaKodesh open, and they are absolutely, they just couldn't breathe. They were so taken with the experience. And I said, you know, like he says over here, learn from the non-Jewish neighbors. We open up the ark, so, you know, you're talking about the giants, so you have to continue your conversation. And, you know, what's going on here? And I'm talking to myself because, you know, we all have a problem, I think, with this sometimes. Just the idea that shul should be that, because we do it so often, it doesn't become that important experience that it really should be. Opening up the Aron should take our breath away. It should be something that, wow. And I'll never forget it. Those kids really taught me a lesson. So I just mentioned that because it was such a special moment, and I thanked them for it, even though they didn't know what I was talking about. What's the rabbi going on about? The rabbi's going a bit soft in the head, I think they thought, but that's the way it was. It was funny at the time. Again, back to the page. So again, what did Elkanah say to his family? He said the following, and we're just in the middle of that first long paragraph, where it's underlined. Limdu derech avodah min haKnani min haAkub. Let's learn a way of service from the nations, from the Canaanites, and from everybody else around us. Shasu derech lavodah zarshel, and they would make a pilgrimage to their idol all the time. Afal pi shehem hevel v'rik, and even though what they're going to is complete waste of space, it's absolute nonsense. The idol is nothing. So kal v'chomer, how much more so? That you've got to go to the Aron, you've got to see the Ark of the Covenant, you've got to go to the Mishkan. How much more so should we be going there? Shehu El Chai V'Kayom, which is the place of the living God. Brit Shemei L'Olam Ramei Olmaya, as we say, this is Yehi Shemei Rabba, the same thing. May his name be blessed forever. Omar Lahem Shialu Kulamimo, so he said, family's got to come with. And of course this was kind of persuasive. Uncle Elkanah tells you to go, you don't mess around. Now listen to this. That's his mishpacha, so he can get away with it with them. But now he decides, well, maybe we can try it on everybody else. Ukasholimimo. So they used to go as a group. So they came to a certain town on the way to Shiloh, and they would stay in the street. You know, this is, in, let's say, for Shavuot or whatever. It was nice and hot. Wouldn't have to worry about being outside overnight. It was pretty warm. And they may have had tents. I don't know what they did. And obviously very appropriate, they would have the men in their section, the women in their section, shekein ha'ish ha'yamadabeh ma'ish, and they would then ask the men of the family to start talking to the men of the town. So these guys would start having a conversation with the other guys, where they would meet, I don't know, they went to the bar, I don't know where they went. V'ha'ishai v'ha'ishai, the women would meet, you tell me where, wherever. And the gadolim katan, and the older ones with the younger ones, right? They'd go and try and meet the kids. They'd sort of, you know, go and play basketball with them. I don't know what they did. Vaitam dinam rageshet. This is a fabulous expression. He says the whole country began to feel his presence. One person. And he already began to have an influence, literally on town by town by town. And he says, vayusholim lahem. And they asked them, Leichan Telchu, where are you going? You know, after they had these conversations, they would ask Elkanah's family, where are you going? This is a wonderful family, you're all going together, where are you off to? The Omrim Lahem, Lebeit Elokim Shebeshila, we're going to the house of God in Shiloh, which clearly had fallen into disrepair or disaffection because people weren't going there. Shemisham Tetzei Torah Masim Tovim, this is the place of Torah and good deeds, and the Atem Lama Lo Tavo Imanu. And he said, why don't you come with us? Not just the family, but you people, people of the shtot, wherever the town they were in, come with. The Nelech B'Yachah will go together. Miyad, and this is the Yiddish and the Shomer. What happened? Einehem Meshagrim Dema'ot, they burst into tears. V'omrim Lachem Na'aleh Mochim, we'll come with. Of course we'll come with. It just took somebody to remind us. We were so busy planting and sowing and doing everything that we did in the fields. We read about all of this in Sefer Shoftim. They forgot their obligation to go to the house of God three times a year. And he, of course, made it even four times a year to show them that it wasn't just an obligation, but it was something that they should take upon themselves voluntarily as well. And look what happened. V'chein omar lahem od hapam, he would say to them again, ad sholei imo l'shana haba chamisha batim, instead of having four families or two families, he would have five families. You know, every year he would gather more and more people. L'shana acheret alu imo asara batim, then 10 families would come with him. L'shana, this is one person. L'shana acheret higishu kulam la'alot, then the whole city would go with him. After being there for a number of years, they know this was the time Elkanah was coming through with his whole crowd, and let's all go, let's all join him. It's a phenomenal thing, unbelievable way, you know, sort of influence. There you go, just got another sheep there. And he goes on, and it doesn't stop there, listen to this. By the time he'd finished, it says that 60 households would go with him. Then he decided, well, I'm going to now change my route. I go a certain route one year. I'll go a different route the other year. So one day I'll take the Kvish Achof, I'll take the coast road, and then I'll go Kvish, whatever is the Jordan Valley road, right? And I'll go in a different way. And he affected the whole of the Jewish people. Unbelievable. One person. And he got them to do this mitzvah of going back to the Mishkan. He got everybody so excited about going to the Mishkan, going to the place, and wow, it was unbelievable. And, you know, I mentioned this a few weeks ago that we make a mistake. We say, and I always quote Nachum Siegel on this, because he says this on his radio show the whole time, that we think the holiest place in the Jewish world is the Western Wall. It isn't. It's number two. The holiest place is the Temple Mount. The only issue is that we're not as passionate about it as we should be. We've just let it slide into the hands of, essentially, the enemy of Israel. Right? Why we're not up there? Why we're not screaming and shouting? There are a group of people that do that, but very few. And we don't seem to, you know, we haven't got our act together on this. And if we could only get our act together on this, this would be such a rallying point for the Jewish people, bring us all together. I don't know. I wonder about this. I really do. And I'm not quite sure. In 67, a lot of people say that it was a tremendous error of the Israeli government. I don't know. I don't know if I can blame the Israeli government. I'm not sure where we stand in relation to the Temple Mount at this point in time. But that's just a bit political, and I don't want to get too political. When you learn Novi, you have to get a bit political, so excuse me. But thank God, not American politics. It's only Israeli politics. The American one, I don't understand what's going on. V'haya Elkanah machria et kol Yisrael lekav sechut. And one person, he says, this is the Tana d'Beliyahu, he says he brought everybody into merit. The whole of the Jewish people, one man. V'chinech otam b'mitzvot v'zalcha rabim al yado. And the whole congregation, as it were, the whole of the Jewish people merited through him. And he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shebokhe Levavot Klayot, God who looks into your heart and inside you, Omar Elkanah, he says to Elkanah, Atayich Ra'ata Yisrael Lekav Sechut, you brought the Jews into merit because of what you did. V'chinachtotam b'mitzvot, and you gave them a chinuch, an education in mitzvot. V'zochu Rabim Al Yadacha, and so many people merited because of what an unbelievable zechut. Chayecha by your life, ani otzi mimcha ben, you're going to have a special son, right? This is not about Chanah. Chanah doesn't even feature, well, I suppose she's part of the entourage, but it's Elkanah, this is the man, and he merits a son who's going to be so special. Sheyachriat kol Yisrael lekav sechut, he's going to be the absolute person to bring the Jewish people into merit, and that's of course Shmuel. V'chanech otam b'mitzvot, he's going to educate the Jews in mitzvot. V'yizku rabim al yado, so many people will merit because of him. Hol amadato b'schar ma'aseh Elkanah Shmuel. Why was Shmuel born? Because of the deeds, the action of Elkanah. It's an unbelievable statement. Wow. It takes your breath away thinking about this and the way the people reacted to him. And everybody started crying. I'll take your question in a second. I'll never forget when I was in the Israeli army. I did my army service in Israel a long time ago, 20 years ago. It was Hanukkah time, and we were in the middle of a very deserted part of the country, somewhere near Yericho. And it was like there were six religious guys, and there was like 100 what we would generally call irreligious guys. And it's Hanukkah time, right? So what do you do Hanukkah in Israel? Sufganiyot, you have to have donuts. So where do you get donuts in the middle of the desert? It was a bit of a problem. I'll never forget this. Have you ever seen Lawrence of Arabia? It's a wonderful scene where they're trekking over the desert, and you have this kind of skyline with the camels and the people. I was looking out one day, it was like middle of the day, and I see three guys trekking over the desert, and I thought I'm having deja vu. I thought this is Lawrence of Arabia all over again. And it's three Chabadskas, three guys from Chabad, and they're schlepping donuts in the middle of the desert to get to the army base so they can give us donuts and put on tefillin. The guys lined up. I've never seen anything like that in my life. The line to put on tefillin, you know, we had a minion, but this line was out of the door. And, you know, you can't beat that. How they found us, I'll never know. Because this is like off the beaten track. You needed a truck to get to us. And they schlepped, and unbelievable. And this is what we're talking about here. This is the same thing that, you know, one person or group or whatever can change the world. And it just takes my breath away, this. Sorry? And food is always going to help. But they brought the tefillin, and the guys put on tefillin. Guys who you wouldn't even remember. I always find this with Israelis, particularly secular Israelis, that you just scratch the surface a little bit, wow, it's there. The neshama is so strong. And it's just been starved. The Israeli school system starves them of Jewish education. It's tragic what goes on there. But that's a story for another time. Sorry, your question.
Yeah, how does that image of Elkanah that you're painting,
yeah,
how does that jive with his telling Chana, am I not better for you than 10
seconds? There you go. You've asked the question of questions, so we're going to deal with that. All right? Now, what I'm going to say is going to be, I hope, a realistic concept, and I have to put it very bluntly, and it's the discussion about Oscar that we had before. I'll answer the question straight away. Later on, I'll explain the question again. Elkanah later on, when he's dealing with his wife's sterility, he seems to be the most insensitive guy in the world. Am I not better for you than 10 sons? Right? Not understanding, this woman's crying her eyes out. For years and years, she hasn't got a baby. And what's going on here? And again, I have to say, and I preface this with a very short story, and to say that one of the real yisodot, the foundations of Novi that I really do believe in, is that on the one hand we're dealing with incredible people, but at the same time we're dealing with human beings. And very often you'll read commentaries and books written about certain individuals, and particularly I have to mention Artscroll, and I'm not going to beat around the bush on this, because they produce books about certain rabbis which are so unrealistic, they're just not true. I know the Feinstein family went berserk. And I heard this from various sources, that they put out stories, the whole book about Reb Moshe is made up. And it's not even, most of those stories did not actually happen to Reb Moshe. They had, that they were nice sort of rabbinic lessons. Did they really happen to him? And I think I heard one of the names of one of the sons who said this, a very nice book about a rabbi, nothing to do with our father. And it wasn't about him. And it's really scary. It's scary because what you're doing is you're fabricating history here. And why are they doing that? Because they want to show the people to be perfect, super perfect. And the whole reason why this became an issue was because in 1988, let's tell you a little bit of current history, there was a dinner in Lakewood, in one of the Lakewood institutions, and they gave a souvenir. And the souvenir was a book called My Uncle the Natsir. I don't know, it's a well-documented story. And what happened was that this book was a first Artscroll history book. And the reason why it was so good was because it wasn't written by an Artscroll rabbi. It was written by the Natsiv, who's Reb Natoli Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, one of the great rabbis of the Lozhen of the 19th century. His nephew, the Torah Tumim, Rabbi Epstein, wrote about his uncle. And they translated from the Hebrew into English, and it's a fabulous book. And the problem is that it was a realistic book, because it said that he used to have arguments with his wife. Oy vey. And not only that, but it even said things like he had friends who were not religious. Oy gaval. And it said even more shocking that he read a newspaper on Shabbos. Right? Now that's really scary. And it goes on. And it talks about Soloveitchik. J.B. Soloveitchik's great-grandfather, he's named after, was married twice. And he says an interesting thing that Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi, he got depressed. His second marriage, his second wife had 8 children who he had to look after on top of his own family. And he couldn't support them from the yeshiva. The yeshiva did not, surprise, surprise, the yeshiva didn't pay him enough. You know, nothing's changed in the world. And he got depressed. And he got sad. And this book was so real because it was saying, on the one hand, these are great people, but they also have human struggles. And the people in Lakewood couldn't handle it. And the book was withdrawn. And they actually approached Artscroll to rewrite it. Because it was so shocking to them to think that the Natsiv was like a real human being. On the one hand, such a great man. On the other hand, such a real human being. They couldn't handle it. And this is, if you want to read about this, J.J. Schachter, who now lives in Teaneck, he's written a whole article about this in the Torah Mother Journal, one of the first journals that came out in 1990, 91. He wrote all about this whole thing. And the bottom line of it is, and I think it's really about what we're learning here, when we're dealing with someone like Elkanah, on the one hand, we'll see to the community, he has one persona. To his family, not so successful. To his family, the reality was he was a communal guy. He was a kehillah person. And this is the Rav's challenge. The rabbi has a big challenge the whole time. How do you balance, on the one hand, my kids used to hate it, how do you balance giving so much to the community and having them to have time for your family? And it's very hard. It's very tough. And one guesses that Elkanah, who was such a brilliant conveyor of the message, right? You know, the gospel, pardon the expression, whatever it is, of getting people to go to Yerushalayim, getting to go to Shiloh in this case. And at the same time, when he came to his own family, he had faults. He didn't. He was human. And when he came to his wife, he really did not understand what she was going through. All right? He thought that just because he's around with a big smile, he could comfort her in a situation where she's a neighbor, she's been praying for a child for nearly 20 years. And he got it wrong. And the reality is that that is a very human person. A person who can succeed on the public level, and in his private life, you know, surprise, surprise, there were issues. Like the rabbi who did have arguments with his wife, or did not necessarily manage to sort of have such an easy time, because there are always challenges. And I think that's the rabbi. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu becomes such a human person because of that. He has challenges, and we respect him not just for his greatness of spirituality, but for his humanity as well. right, as much as there was. And with Moshe, it's very easy, and it's mainly spiritual, but there are examples of humanity there. And I think this is what it's about. You understand what I'm saying? And that's what Elkanah seems to have got the message for the public, phenomenal message. For himself, not so great. For his family. And I always quote in this case the former chief rabbi of London, of England, Lord Jacobitz, Zichron Livracha, who was the rabbi here in Fifth Avenue. And he always spoke about this because he said that one of the things that he made absolutely Kodesh Kodshim for him was to, every summer he went away with the kids. He took them away for a month and he took an RV. England call that caravan, and you used to go all over the country, and there was no cell phones in those days, which is wonderful. That was the good old days, right before they could get hold of you wherever. And he used to insist that he spent absolute 100% quality time with all of the family for a month, no interruption. There could be World War III going on, and they would have to leave him a message somewhere. He said, I'm going to be in Birmingham, then I'm going to be in Newcastle, I'm going to be in Leeds, and he left places where they could contact him, leave messages, and if it was really the major sort of thing, you know, the Queen had died or something, then he would have to go back to London, otherwise he wasn't interested. And the family today is very, very solid. You meet all of his kids, they're absolutely 100%, you know, it's hard to describe it, but they are just sort of, you know, the family sense that he created was really very unique. And for Rabbanim, it's a very big challenge to balance, on the one hand, your public persona and getting it right with the family at the same time. And a lot of rabbis, you know, unfortunately, we know cases, so many cases, it didn't happen. There's a case in London, Dinah Bumsky, who was in London for years, one of the famous Dionysians. He had two or three sons. One of them became a major communist. All right, he's the most learned communist in the world. Doesn't keep anything, but he can learn Gemara better than anyone in this room put together. He's a phenomenal Baal Gemara, but he has he doesn't keep anything. All right, and he's been like that for the last 60 years. And his father was one of the great Gaonim of pre-war Europe. It's unbelievable. And there's so many cases like this. So I'm sorry I had to go into a bit of a digression, but that's the answer essentially to your question. Very human. Doesn't get it right with his family. It's a challenge, and it's very sad. And that's a side of Elkanah which I suppose we have to come to terms with. We're not very excited about, but that's the reality. That's the way he is. All right, how are we doing? Oh, we're doing for... Okay. I just want to see a little bit more on the page that you have in front of you, and just to see the way that this rabbi who presents this particular piece ties it all together. He says, Aliyato, just the last two paragraphs. Aliyato zu lerego dashu chazal. The rabbis explain on this Aliyah Lerego, Va'ala Ishahu, we saw the words Va'ala, he went up. What does that mean? Nit Aleha Ish Bebeto. The man was, as it were, elevated. He was raised up in his own home. Nit Aleha Ish Bechatzero, became elevated in his Chatzer and his surroundings. Nit Aleha Be'iro, in his city. Nit Aleha Bechol Yisrael, and eventually amongst the whole of the Jewish people. V'chol Iluyam, Lo Haya Ella Mashal Atzman. It was all because of what he did. All right, the power of one, as I said over here. If you've never seen the movie, it's a good movie. Power of One, great film, made about 1991. Apartheid story. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Power of One. Never seen it? Oh, it's a very good movie. So it's also about the power of the same idea, in a pretty different setting, but one person trying to change the whole world. Very, very, very good film. All right. So this is final point of it. So we've learned from here. Derech Aliyato Matmedeshal, this is the rabbi sort of tying up this particular point, that he used to go again and again and again, go up to Shiloh. Shiloh haya od bedoro kiyotzebo. Nobody was like him. Aliyah ruchanit ratzufa, continual increase in spirituality. Mimizgato tznua mishpachtit, he started off with his family, very tznua, very modest. Mimizgeret b'nei ha'iro, then to his city. Ad lezikuyam, zikuyim shakaiso, to eventually meriting the whole of the Jewish people. Wow. V'kach haya biyado ladrichet b'nei doro, and then eventually the whole generation, he guided them. Lechancham lemitzvot, lachriya otam lekavzichut, to bring them into merit. Hadugma ha'ishit, this personal example, ha'moreret et ra'av l'arim, that brings people who see it to the thought, oh, yeah, well, he can do it, and maybe we can do the same. Mikan latavata masim kulam. This brings everybody into a better situation. B'sachar zikuya rabim b'mitzvazu, zachar libeno agadol. That's why he had such a great son. In the end of the day, it wasn't just about Chana and her tefillah. The chiddush of all of this is that Elkanah was also a very, very unique individual. And something very interesting, which comes out later on, and you have the text in front of you. If you just look in chapter 7, I'll just show you something kind of unusual here. When it describes Shmuel's activity as a shofet, we saw here the idea of Elkanah going from place to place, around and around. As my grandmother said, a rim and a rim. And he went all over the place. Look at this interesting thing. It's the end of chapter 7, Pasuk Tet Zayin, verse 16. V'halach, this is describing Shmuel. V'halach midei shana b'shana. Same thing. Every year he would go. V'savav bet el v'gilgal v'mitzpah. He went from one to the other to the other. He went to all these different places. He was a traveling judge. V'shafat et Yisrael et kol ha'mekomot ha'ele. And he judged Israel in all of these places. He took the word to the people. He wasn't waiting for the people to come to him. He was out there. And he went around the whole year. He went around place to place in order to spread this particular message of mishpat, justice, etc. And of course, where did he learn this from? His father. Right? Where else? He saw his father do what he did, bringing everybody together and traveling this four times a year to, and once was this voluntary trip that they made to the Mishkan on top of everything else, and he learned it, and he applied it in his own life. This is the greatest thing a parent can see, is a child who actually carries out what, you know, who does what, you put it into them. You know, I always hear the parents complaining, you know, the kids want to go live in Israel. You know, you work so hard to give them a Zionistic education. Surprise, surprise, they want to go live in Israel. You know, what are we kidding ourselves? We work so hard to put them into schools. Well, they would get all of that, and then they turn around afterwards and say, well, maybe they want to go and live there. And then we start getting a bit apprehensive. There's something wrong with this picture. But anyway, that's the way it is. And he just says at the end of the chapter, Chuvatara Matane, he would come home once a year, Kisham Beito, because he had to come back to his home, for Sham Shafat Yisrael, Vinusham Mizbeach Lashem. That's where he built his Mizbeach, and he came home. And it's phenomenal that you see Shmuel really internalizing the message of his father in such a way. Of course, what he gets from his mother is something that, you know, we'll obviously be able to see in the future as well. That will already become clear next week. We got a few minutes. I just want to do one or two more psukim and set the scene for the next year, because not only are we dealing with a special guy, but we're also dealing with a very complicated family situation, and I just want to set the problem, and Mitzvah Hashem will deal with the issue next week. So just have a look at this. And it's Pasuk Dala, verse 4. So the day came when he made a sacrifice. And he gave to Penina and all of her sons and daughters, and there's a whole discussion how many kids she has, we'll see later on. He gave them portions. He gave her something which was choice. Apayim is something which has got a special flavor to it or whatever. He had chana ahev, Hashem sagarachma. He loved chana, and Hashem did not allow her to have children, close the womb. And as a consequence of her situation, this is now a very strange part of the story, and I'm just setting up the situation, but I'm not going to give you the conclusion of this until next week. The kiasatad saratah gamkas. We know that the co-wife, meaning the second wife, Penina, caused vexation, caused anger to the first wife, Chana. Bavor harima, to try and get her, as it were, as he says over here, to anger her, essentially to get her riled up in order to daven a bit more. Ki sagar Hashem ba'ad rachma, because God had denied her children. Penina here, the other wife who's blessed with children, turns around to Chana. And there is, for instance, a description of what she did. And it's actually on the page in front of you on the second side. I'm just going to read the description, and then we'll set up the question, and we'll leave it for next time. He said the question is, "V'keitzad hichi yasta." The same page on the left hand side. How did she anger her? How did Penina do this? Ki yasta tzarata gam kas mach eser v'chozei mach eser. She angered her again and again. Maita merida. What did she say? Kanita lebincha gadol sudar l'sheni chaluk. In other words, I've just come back from Toys R Us. So I just come back from Babies R Us. And here we have, what is it called? A onesie. All right? I always thought there should be a twosie, but apparently there isn't. I've got this, you know, I've come back with all these clothes. Where's your clothes, Hannah, for the baby? Where's your shirt? Where's the shirt for the child? Where's the suda? Where's the diaper, right? Where are all these things that you should have? And of course, Hannah's sitting there sobbing her eyes out. And the question is, what is Penina doing here? On the one hand, you can say, all right, so she's trying to get Chana to pray and to pour her heart out in grief. But are you allowed to put somebody in such, through the ringer like this, in such a situation to elicit prayer, to elicit some sort of tefillah like this? Is this allowed? So what we're going to deal with next week essentially is the very complicated relationship between Penina and Chana, and try and understand Penina's motivation. And what's more shocking is the fact that in the end, Chana has the child, and Penina starts getting a terrible onesh. The rabbis explain, every time Chana had a baby, she eventually has four or five children, every time she has one child, two of Penina's dies. And there's something very, very difficult to come to terms with. What is happening in terms of the way that Penina is behaving here? And then eventually, how do we explain the punishment that Penina actually endures? And that's going to be a very interesting insight from the Miriam Rosh Hashiva, from Chaim Shmulevitz, some very great man who I met once, passed away not so long ago, a few years ago, and gives us a very interesting insight to be continued in Hashem next week. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.